This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lushershute. Today, I am speaking with Tom Philpott, former farmer and current food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones magazine. We talk about the complex future of confinement meat production in the U.S. and what the chicken and pig farmers of North Carolina are facing in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence.
Hi, I'm Emily Mickley Doyle, farmer at Sprout NOLA and organizer with the Greater New Orleans Growers Alliance. I've been a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition since 2013 because I believe that young people can be torchbearers for current and future generations in creating community-based food systems. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to being part of a bright and just future for agriculture in the United States, you'll also get discounts like 10% off high-mowing organic seeds and 15% off Rosie's workwear for women. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
When you were living and farming in North Carolina, did you have any interaction with these farms and farmers on the eastern side of the state that had very different types of operations?
Well, you know, basically what the CAFOization of eastern North Carolina is a story of the collapse of the tobacco economy there. You know, most of the owners that aren't part of the giant company that operates there that does raise a bunch of hogs are former tobacco farmers. And this sort of hog CAFO idea was, well, tobacco has collapsed, so here's another money-making opportunity.
Right. And just so everyone knows, we're talking about a confined animal feeding operation. When somebody asks you, Tom, how do you define that for someone?
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of define it as a substantial operation, a large operation that, you know, confines a bunch of animals together indoors in one place.
And this is how the majority of meat in America is grown.
Yeah, I mean, I would say even the vast majority. I think pastured operations are growing really fast, but from a very small base. I can tell you from reporting I've done, even with antibiotic-free chicken, that's probably going to come from a CAFO. And even organic chicken, access to outdoors is pretty limited. And so even organic production in general, there's a strong possibility that it could be from a CAFO.
I was going to ask you this later on in this conversation, but I'm just going to ask you now. I mean, given that so much of what Americans are consuming is from these types of operations, and the price, right, difference between what's raised in confinement and what's raised on pastures is significant. Like, you've been a critic of some of these operations, and I'm just wondering, like, where do you hope to end up, right? Like, changing this is not going to be quick, right? And
yeah,
we still need people to have diverse diets, and we, you know, want people to have access to protein and whatnot. So I'm just wondering, like clearly there's a line that's been crossed. And I think in North Carolina, that's quite evident on, like, from the environmental perspective. But, like, where's the balance there where, you know, we recognize people's very limited budgets, and then on the other side of things, like the very costly confinement operation that has all these other, you know, externalities, all these other costs that are not captured in like that container of chicken?
I think that's a really good and hard question. But, you know, one thing that I have found in my research over the years is that there isn't, like, let's just start with hogs. There is a middle ground between, you know, the giant indoor operation, that on one extreme, and then sort of the you know, true pastured operation on the other. There is a middle ground. I mean, I can envision a world where it ranges between pastured and a kind of high tunnel deep bedding system.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, you know, definitely more expensive than the sort of CAFO pork. And, you know, then you start shifting the conversation over to, do we need to have a system that creates a whole bunch of cheap meat, that makes meat to be this thing that you expect three times a day? And I think there are similar conversations to be had about both cows and chickens, where there are hybrid systems. You know, and I've become semi-convinced that, you know, maybe this industrial organic system that a lot of companies are doing, I think Purdue is jumping into it in a big way. You know, if that were the most extreme and sort of high production form of chicken production, I could probably live with that. Instead, you know, if that were like, that's the baseline, and then we have pastured chicken and other forms of chicken on top of that, I think that would probably be okay. And, you know, because, you know, chickens are, you know, they, the manure they produce, they sort of, even in these big CAFOs, they use a kind of a deep bedding system. They, you know, the manure goes on to the straw or whatever they're using, and you get, it's a little bit more manageable, but it's a lot more manageable than hog. So I think finding middle roads where producers that are doing pastured would get a premium, but taking the more extreme forms, like what we're seeing in Eastern North Carolina with hogs, and making them much more benign, maybe a little bit more expensive, but more environmentally benign.
It's just complex because I feel like there's a situation where you have these producers that are in these situations where they're in such great risk, right? Like they have all these loans and capital like put into the system that, you know, they were told this is like the best thing. And so they're kind of like up against a wall, right? And
yeah,
like obviously there needs to be regulation in place so we're protecting our waterways and communities and whatnot, but like they need a path to get to something that's more manageable, and it's complicated.
Yeah, that is a great point, because in the situation of both many hog farmers and also almost all poultry farmers, almost all American poultry is made under contract with, you know, what is essentially four or five massive companies that dominate the market. And they, you know, have done this masterful job of grabbing the one profitable part of producing chicken, which is, you know, the final sale of the chicken to the retailer.
Right.
And then what the farmer owns is all the risky parts. You know, a disease comes through your flock and the birds don't grow as fast, or, you know, a third of them die. That's your problem. A hurricane comes through and kills your flock. That's between you and your insurance. And so they, you know, they put all the risk off. And one of those risks they put off is this massive amount of manure that, when you have a whole bunch of these operations tightly confined to one place, like Eastern North Carolina or the Eastern Shore of Maryland, you're producing more than can be absorbed by the land. And when you get pollution and all, you know, sort of nitrates leaking into water, and, you know, the villain becomes the farmer, and the company can step back and say, hey, you know, those aren't our operations. Those are merely our contractors.
Yeah, it's really tricky. The farmers are definitely in a difficult spot. So update us on what's happening right now in North Carolina after Florence.
Well, you know, one thing that I don't think people quite get is that if you're a farmer in Eastern North Carolina, you've got a hog operation or a chicken house, and one of these massive storms comes through, what you have to do is you have to brace for two major cataclysms. The first one is the storm itself. You know, you're right there, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles from the coast. And, you know, the storm is still going to be raging when it hits. It dissipates as it goes across the land, but you're still right there at the cutting edge. And so you've got this massive storm. And so what happens is that if, you know, these operations have got to have their fans running, you know, full time. They've got to, you know, these huge fans that circulate the air and keep the air from getting stagnant. And if the power goes out during that initial cataclysm, then, you know, you get your generator going, and, you know, you might have 45 minutes to get it back up running again. And if you don't, your flock of chickens is probably going to be dead. And so you weather that, and there can be flooding in that period.
Is that
as well.
Actually what the window is, 45 minutes?
Depending on how big the birds are, but if you have a fairly mature flock, you've got 45 minutes. And it's a 45-minute period where the skies have opened up and are raining like mad, and wind is blowing like crazy, and, you know, it's just, I can't even imagine it. So you get through that first part, and it could last a day, it could last 2 days. the storm moves west. As the storm moves west, it's continuing to just, you know, put down amazing amounts of rain. That rain is going into rivers, and you are bracing now in 2 to 3 days a massive surge of rivers. And that really is the most desperate part, because now you've got this uncontrollable situation. And, you know, eastern North Carolina is full of rivers, carrying water from the Appalachian Mountains to the sea. So it's got this sort of network of rivers, and many, many of these operations are in the floodplain. And that's when it's just like this incredible mess. And so in the days after the hurricane hit, Hurricane Florence hit, the landfall wasn't as harsh as they expected. But the second part was basically as bad as it could have been. It's like this slow-moving train wreck. And you've got hundreds and hundreds of these manure lagoons just sitting there. And when the flood hits them, they carry the water. They carry the manure, the liquid manure. They carry it from the lagoon just into the water stream. And then oftentimes, like, there's this great organization called Water Keepers, and they do these overhead photos. And if you look on.
Yeah, I saw some of them that you shared on Mother Jones.
You can see in the pictures that when the storm waters subside, the flood waters subside, you can see the manure has seeped into the landscape. You can see it, actually. Like, you can see, like, sort of like the black indentation of it going into the landscape. And it's sitting there, you know, and it's basically toxic. It's way, way more.
It's just on the land.
Yeah, it ends up in stream beds, and it ends up seeping into groundwater and getting into wells, and it just causes all these problems. And so, I'm forgetting the numbers, but I think that something like many dozens of these lagoons breached and were overtopped and sent millions and millions of gallons of this slurry of feces and urine with antibiotic resistant pathogens, antibiotic residues, other pharmaceuticals. The pork industry widely uses a couple of growth promoters that you don't want to have contact with. All this sort of slurry of chemicals and feces and urine just ends up in streams, inland, for a while after the storm. And that's exactly what happened.
And so who's responsible for cleaning it all up? Who owns the shit?
Right.
Well, like, is that the company, because it's from the animal, or is it like once it's out of the animal, that belongs to the farmer?
Once it's out of the animal in a situation like that, it belongs to society. It's one of those things that, it's really, really hard to clean up. I mean, how would you go about cleaning it up? How would you go about getting it out of muck? And how would you get, how do you go about getting it out of people's water except for filtration, and, who's going to pay for that?
But I assume, like, the North Carolina Department of Environmental Conservation, Environmental Quality is monitoring the safety of any of these areas to make sure that humans aren't coming in contact with them. Like, maybe if nobody's going to clean it up, at least nobody should be exposed to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely monitoring, but, and even when this stuff is functioning well, even when there's not a massive hurricane, what they do is they spray that liquid slurry of manure onto land. But there's just simply not enough land to absorb it. And so you get over application. And so you already have this process of seepage in the groundwater. There's already water quality issues in eastern North Carolina. And an event like this just exacerbates it.
And just, to, emphasize that right now in eastern North Carolina, they're like pigs significantly outnumber the human population.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what happens if a well is inundated or contaminated by some of this feces? Like, what does it do to the water?
Well, it can put nitrates into water, and the EPA standard for nitrates is 10 parts per million. This is a huge issue in Iowa as well. And so what the industry says in general is that, don't worry about it. Nitrate's not that bad for you. There's not that many health impacts of it. And, you know, the most extreme one is called blue baby syndrome. And that is if a mother gets a lot of nitrates at the end of pregnancy and the baby also gets nitrates, it can make the blood unable to process oxygen. And so the baby essentially suffocates. And there isn't a lot of blue baby syndrome going on because people are really careful. That hasn't become a big issue. And so what the ag industry says is, well, no blue babies, no problem. But there's this growing body of research, and there's this researcher at University of Iowa who's documenting this, that low-level constant exposure to nitrates, even under the 10 parts per million threshold, but even at levels like 5 and 6 parts per million, there's chronic effects and there's associations with all kinds of cancers. And so you really, really don't want nitrates in your water.
And a lot of like the neighbors, the nearby communities, if they're rural, they're on a well system. So they have untreated water.
They have untreated water. They're not necessarily regularly testing. And so, you know, you routinely get people drinking water above the legal limit. And, you know, and then there's issues like when you get these nutrients, nitrogen in seawater and phosphorus is the main one for freshwater. They both feed algae that can create dead zones, and it can also make water poisonous. There's a certain kind of blue-green algae that happens in freshwater that is driven by phosphorus, and there's a lot of phosphorus in pig shit, if I can say that on your podcast.
A word that's hard to avoid, honestly.
Yeah, in this conversation, it's a hard one. But there's a lot of phosphorus in it, and it creates these algae blooms, and this happens in the city of Toledo. Many summers, they will get an algae bloom in Lake Erie, where they get their water, that will have this toxin, and they will have to basically shut down the city's water because you can't shower in it. Boiling it will only concentrate the toxin.
And that's from nitrogen fertilizer?
It's from nitrogen fertilizer, but there's also hog CAFOs in that mm. watershed.
So how did so many pigs end up in a floodplain?
Yes, I think that is a really interesting question. And the answer is because the companies could. And, you know, here I am in Austin, Texas, this very kind of vibrant city that, you know, lots of environmentalists and lots of young people who care about what they're eating and are worried about toxins. And so the chance of a company putting a large operation like this in or close to Austin is virtually zero. No company would think about it. In eastern North Carolina, so that has been agricultural land for a long time. It was where cotton and tobacco was grown with slavery in the 19th century. That's where, you know, North Carolina's biggest plantations were. And in fact, if you look at a map of the density of enslaved people in 1860, right as the Civil War was starting, and you compare it to a map of CAFO concentrations in 2018, they virtually completely overlay each other. And so this is area that has been based on, you know, great imbalances in power. The population is 1.5 times more dense with African Americans than the rest of the state. It's 4 times more dense with Native Americans. The incomes tend to be lower. And so you get this situation where you get these sort of marginalized communities, you know, rates of college education are lower. So you get these marginalized communities that don't have a lot of economic power and are very ripe for the picking when it comes to where are we going to put a big, filthy operation.
And I guess maybe someone thinking about this purely from an economic development standpoint might say, oh, well, here are some jobs, right,
right,
for this community. Do these hog operations produce jobs? Like, is that true?
Short answer is no. They're very capital intensive. They need some human labor, but not a whole lot. And the jobs that they do tend to produce are very low income. You know, basically the industry, as it expanded in that area, the game was to play off the African American worker population When it started to get a little bit of labor power going, it really turned to the immigrant, the sort of Mexican and Central American immigrant population to come in and provide competition. You know, pretty explicitly did this. And so what you get...
To provide competition for the local labor.
Yeah, just to make sure, to keep everyone in line and say, okay, you know, don't demand more wages because we've got this other population. And there has been research done about, you know, what happens when you get a density of confinement operations in an area. And generally what you get instead of economic development is a hollowing out. Because they're so capital and not labor intensive, they don't produce enough jobs, you know, per capita to make very much of a difference. They make it an undesirable place to live. And so
for any other industries that might want to be there,
and,
or just families.
And then, you know, then you start getting stuff like, well, you know, people are moving out, so the hardware store is closing down, and, you know, you get that kind of spiral. And I think the industry is even sheepish about really arguing that these days, because there's just no data to back it up.
That this is good from an economic development standpoint.
Yeah.
Right. And the hog industry is also facing some lawsuits, or has faced this year some lawsuits from neighbors of some of these operations. And what is the update there on how those nuisance lawsuits are going?
I think this is actually a really happy part of the story, and that is that you do have this population that tends to be poor, tends to be, you know, heavily African American and Native American compared to other parts of the state, and so it's vulnerable. But the community is pushing back. People have been pushing back, you know, basically since this stuff started 20 or 25 years ago. And the state took a hard right-wing turn around 2012. And since Republicans began to dominate the state house around that time, that the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality infamously was ignoring the concerns of people who live there. And, you know, Trump's EPA actually chastised the NCDEQ last year for not taking these complaints seriously. And so what the shift became was, well, let's, if we're not getting very far in the political system, let's go to the courts. And so a bunch of nuisance lawsuits were launched, I think hundreds of them. And the idea was that, you know, look, your operation here, you are destroying my quality of life. I can't leave my house, especially when you're spraying your manure. Our asthma rates are higher. Our rates of other health indicators are higher than they are elsewhere. There's a lot of research backing this up. And so you're destroying my quality of life. And so I'm going to launch a nuisance lawsuit against you. And the first three of these were tried this year. And all three of them, they sided with the plaintiffs. And they awarded millions and millions of dollars to the plaintiffs. And there are, you know, because this industry is so powerful, there are limitations on what you can award in a nuisance suit.
Limitations that were imposed by the legislature.
Yeah. And I think the punitive damages will come down, but they're still in the millions, and there's still a bunch more cases to go. And there's still this precedent of juries siding with the plaintiffs. And so I think it's going to put massive, massive pressure on the industry. And they're freaking out about it. They got a bunch of their politicians together, including Trump's USDA and the State Department of Agriculture and a bunch of agribusiness executives. They had a high profile meeting. You know, how are we going to respond to the menace of these nuisance lawsuits? But it is making the industry think that maybe we can't do this here very much longer. And possibly these storms coming through are also giving them that idea that this ends up being a really bad place.
Right.
You know, one thing I learned, I don't think I got this in any of my pieces, but if you look at other places where the hog industry is really concentrated, and the main one being Iowa, the number one hog growing state, the areas where it's concentrated are way less population dense than North Carolina. So even though hogs outnumber people in those counties in North Carolina, those are still pretty population dense places compared to Iowa. And so what I would foresee is industry strategy will be, is going to be, let's move to places that are less population dense. So we're not getting this concentration of people who are going to push back against us. And so if I were living in Iowa or Minnesota or Missouri, these Midwestern places, I would be bracing to organize against more, you know, sort of CAFOs, the industry slowly moving its operations and concentrating its growth away from North Carolina, you know, this coastal area that has these hurricanes and floods and has this population that is pissed off and are launching successful lawsuits to inland areas that are a little bit less population dense. So I think that's going to be a big fight going forward, is an expansion away from North Carolina into other areas.
You know, it's, okay. So I did have one clarifying question. These lawsuits, do they implicate the farmer or the company that owns the animals? Like who's actually going to pay, you know, like write the check to the plaintiffs?
This is a really good question. And one of the things about the hog industry is that a bunch of it is done on contract with individual farmers. But unlike with poultry and chicken, the company themselves, they also produce a lot of hogs. And so in North Carolina, there's a entity called Murphy Brown, and it's a subsidiary of Smithfield. And it is the hog producing operation of Smithfield. And so the company itself runs, dozens and dozens of these CAFOs, and it's this, you know, massive corporate entity. Ultimately, Murphy Brown and Smithfield in this case is holding the bag here, which is a great strategy, I think.
You know, I was reading, you had linked to this lawmaker, Jimmy Dixon, obviously very upset about this situation, and then he shares this post from a farmer, Matthew Carter, and, you know, he says, "Today my family is heartbroken on the verdict of being considered a nuisance to a small few of our neighbors." And they say they've been there for 33 years, et cetera, et cetera. So are they just named in that suit because they're the owner of the hogs? Or I'm just wondering, maybe there's so many lawsuits that some of them are directly linked to these family farm operations.
Right. So my understanding is that the lawsuits that have been tried so far and the general strategy is focusing on Murphy Brown. And I don't think there are other farmers named in the suits. But I can also say that the industry, you know, one of the things that it does is, you know, it has this really, I think, unfair relationship with its farmers. But when they need to, when they're under attack for some reason, they will haul out the family farmer for sure. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of these farmers are in a really bad position because they've got, in some cases, millions of dollars, definitely hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of investment, and they're paying off a note. And they're dependent on these companies. So when the company comes to you and says, "Hey, you know, do us a solid and go, you know, on this ad and talk about how bad nuisance lawsuits are," there's a lot of pressure on you to do that. I also think I could see legitimately a farmer thinking, "Well, today it's Murphy Brown, tomorrow it's me."
And farmers are highly defensive about their practices.
Sure. There is a legitimate idea that, hey, you know, you live in farm country, there's going to be some bad smells. But these manure lagoons are on a whole different level than that.
So, Tom, do you think that I know you've done some coverage on the state legislature in relationship to all this. Do you think that there's going to be action taken from the policy side of things post-Florence to say, you know, I mean, I know there's a moratorium now on these types of operations in North Carolina already, but I imagine somebody's got to do something after this latest round. I mean, 2 years ago, the same thing happened. Or do you think it's not going to play out that
way? I don't know, but it does seem like these two events happening so hot on the heels of one another, just 2016, 2018, there has to be a reckoning. But one of the things that is crazy in North Carolina is that the politics got really kind of Tea Party there. And, you know, one of the sort of articles of faith is that, you know, climate change either doesn't exist or humans don't have anything to do with it. And so there's got to be cognitive dissonance when you have so many, you know, epochal storms happening so fast upon the other. I think it's still too early to tell, but surely people are freaked out. Surely even the executives of Murphy Brown / Smithfield are freaked out. Surely some of the people who operate some of these farms are freaked out. And it does seem like something has to give, but we'll see. There's a major effort in 2017 to not only eliminate future nuisance suits, but it would also invalidate previous ones, ones that are already in motion. And it actually passed the legislature, and the governor vetoed it. And I'm just mentioning that as a just how powerful the industry is. And if Governor McCrory hadn't won in 2016, that law would have passed, and that would have eliminated these nuisance suits. It's kind of a crazy situation.
Wow. It's crazy to think that the state legislature would have the power to eliminate that's just something that I wasn't aware of, that they could say, yeah, that's something you can't sue over. Well, Tom, it's been so interesting to talk to you, and thanks so much for providing such a thorough update on, like, of course, the hurricane, but what came before it and, you know, what's to come, thinking about what's ahead. Of course, we'll remind listeners to check out Bite, which is a great, great podcast. Tom, thanks so much for your time, and hopefully we can talk again.
Thanks for having me on. I look forward to listening to your podcast.
If you want to know more, you can check out more of Tom's work in Mother Jones and hear him on the Bite podcast, as well as the Special Ingredient podcast. Check out the links in the show notes. Thank you, Tom, for being on the show today. If you like what we're doing here, please tell a friend and write us a review in iTunes. This show was recorded with the generous help of Radio Kingston, and it was edited by Hannah Beal. See you next week.